Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
If somebody were to ask you whether you would like to become more vulnerable, what would you say? I'm not so sure about you, but until recently, I'm sure I might have said, I think not now. There's just a little bit too much going on in the world and too many events that are really frightening. But it is because today's world confronts us with so many opportunities for fear that I would like to consider with you this morning what it means to be vulnerable. Now, we humans have always lived with vulnerabilities, whatever age or time. The Buddha taught that we are always subject to the vicissitudes of change, to the defeat of our desires, to sickness, to old age, and to death. The unknown and much fear is built into us. Unitarian Universalist, former minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Manhattan, the late Forest Church, used to echo the Buddha's teaching when he would remind us Unitarian Universalist ministers that the purpose, he said, of religion is to help us live between the two great vulnerabilities of our being, the precariousness of birth and the finality of death. Other mammals are less vulnerable. Some are able to walk even at birth, but we need a long infancy, and we have to remain with our parents to help us along for a good while. The King San tribe of the Kalahari actually bond with their children and nurse them for 3 to 5 years, sometimes 4 to 5 years, and so did Native Americans. To recognize the need for early nurture and support against the vulnerabilities of our existence. We tended to resist feeling another's idiosyncrasies and being vulnerable to them and to the exigencies of life. There's a debate now going on in college campuses as to how far and how much a professor needs to go and to needs to warn students that material they may study may disturb them, as if life were not inherently disturbing. And that it is also very important then to learn methods of coping. We believe that others may age and die, but maybe not us. There's a joke about a woman. She's visiting with her new dentist, and she's waiting in the reception room, and she sees a certificate on the wall that has his full name. Suddenly, she remembers that a tall, handsome boy with that very name had been in her high school class some 40 years ago. Upon seeing him, she quickly discards such thought, though, because this bald and gray-haired man with the deeply lined face was just too old to have been in her class and a classmate. But just to be sure, after he examines her teeth, she asks him if he had attended the local high school. Yes, he did. He replies, I did. Well, when did you graduate, she asks. He answers, in 1957, but why do you ask? Why, she exclaims, you are in my class. Whereupon the dentist looks at her very closely and asks, well, what did you teach? Very often we have to learn about what it is like to be vulnerable in a moment of fear and oftentimes crisis. Perhaps we have the misfortune to be mugged, to be burglarized, to be betrayed, lose our job, or even to face a terrorist attack. Recently, I had a couple of experiences, not anywhere as serious as these, but nevertheless frightening, which taught me a lesson about what it means to be vulnerable. The experience occurred, the first one, 2 years ago. I was on the back patio of my house washing some outdoor furniture with a hose when a dog came rushing into the yard with two other dogs tailing, snarling, and got up close and began lunging at me as I was doing my cleaning. I was very frightened. In reaction, I grabbed the first weapon I could find, which was my hose. So I turned the water on them and screamed at them. Eventually, they backed down and they retreated and growling all the way in their return. This year, I was outside clearing brush from my yard when the very same dog began barking from my neighbor's yard. I remembered last year's experience and I kept an eye on him. As I continued to pick up branches, I saw him circling nearer and nearer and heard him barking louder and louder. And I turned around, I saw that he was about 12 feet away from me, baring his teeth, barking and growling, and then he began to lunge at me. With each lunge, he got closer and closer, growling more, and snapping and baring his teeth. I couldn't remember when you are and when you're not supposed to have eye contact with an aggressive animal. But my eyes at this point engaged his strongly. I knew that if I lunged forward at him, he probably would attack, and probably if I ran away, he would do the same thing. But this time, a different presence occurred inside me. Instead of the anger and fear I had felt last year, I felt this year a presence of calm, of steadfastness, and I will say even compassion. I just stood there in my place, my eyes fastened on his, and I realized I wasn't frightened. And more than that, I marveled that he could become so upset about such an innocent act of mine. I realized he might attack me, but if he did, I felt from this place I can accept it. Whatever happens is going to happen, I thought, but I'm at peace. I do not have to actually resist and be angry or disturbed as he is. I just realized he was so agitated. I began to feel compassionate towards him. I began to silently kind of communicate with him in my mind, sort of saying thoughts like, "It's okay. There's no big need to get upset here. Relax. There's really no problem going on. It's no big deal. Let's chill out." To my surprise, his barks began to attenuate. Each became a little less intense, and more time elapsed between the barks and the growls. This process continued on for several minutes as we stood there confronting each other. And then he almost stopped growling, and eventually he did. With one final snap, he gave me one last glance, turned around, and shuffled back up the little hill to his house. I heaved a sigh of relief. I stood mute for a moment, like the yogi in mountain pose, just feeling a rush of energy throughout my torso, but feeling grounded and secure. Now, I don't share this experience to demonstrate the effect of nonviolence. That's not what I'm after. The dog could have well been impervious to whatever I did. He could have been rabid. But this experience had the effect of affirming for me what it is like not to be violent towards myself, to resist my anger and my aggression that is within me. I realized that when we are can be really aligned with our own self, clear and present, that there is no need to erect a lot of defenses. The need just doesn't arise. Instead, we can accept what is happening, but more than that, we can actually hold it in love. But I learned something more important than this from this confrontation. As the dog retreated, I realized a loss. I was missing that adrenaline rush and the accompanied sense of power and superiority I'd felt a year ago at winning and fighting him off. I realized in that moment, very personally, what it means to inherit this violently wired portion of our brain, and how exhilarated any one of us can become riding on the emotional rush produced by our aggressive nervous system, and how we can mentally thrive on thoughts of retribution, of domination, and superiority. From this experience, I became much more sympathetic to the motivation that underlies our willingness to counterattack. I could feel more fully, I will say, in my heart, what might have driven President George W. Bush to attack Afghanistan after 9/11 and enabled him to stand on his aircraft carrier after invading Iraq beneath a banner proclaiming mission accomplished. I understood more deeply how this drive is in all of us to appear to look invulnerable. And I felt more personally the temptation even of slave masters, even torturers, and yes, even terrorists. How easy it is to succumb to this desire to be invulnerable. How I wish that as a nation, after 9/11, we could have responded with more equanimity instead of aggression. How different things might even be now. In November 2011, two right-wing extremists bombed Oslo and Utøya in Norway, killed 145 people and injured 319, but Norway responded differently than we did. In a memorial service in Oslo 2 days after this tragedy, the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, said, "We are still shocked by what has happened, but we will never give up our values. Our response will be more democracy, more openness, and more humanity." When other nations opened their hearts to us, we were too proud. What we could have gained by following Stoltenberg. Now we're in this terrorist-prone time, and I think we need more than ever to attend to the capacities in the midst of the fear so easily to surround us, to become open to our hearts. There is a soft spot within each of us in which we can reside. Many of us experience this opening in our heart. Some experience it in our heads, kind of a place of perspective, which includes our universal, acknowledges our universal vulnerability, and includes the suffering of all generations and all peoples in our vision. From this perspective, feelings of fear and thoughts and aggression quiet down, and then we may act in a more measured, moderate way, and with some degree of care rather than cursing. Martial arts artists locate this spot in their belly. They call it the hara in Japan and the tantien in China. When an Aikido fighter wishes to summon all the power he has, he attends to this place. And from this, he draws the energy for his defense. He opens to the force of his opponent, the force his opponent throws at him, and he dispels their fused energy in a non-harming third direction. So the result is win-win. The attacker is prevented from the karma of having aggressed. The defender gets to preserve his life or protects others. Acting from this kind of soft power, I believe we can resist all of them as much as we need to, but we can resist more nonviolently, and we can remain compassionate. And then there's the American student I heard about who was traveling to visit an Indian guru who was full of love. And as she prepared to board a bus in the rain, a thief stole her purse, and it had all of her money and her passport, too. So she arrived quite distraught to greet the guru. And the guru saw her so upset and asked her to tell him what happened. And she explained, and his response was, "Well, why, with all the love you could muster in your heart, did you not hit him over the head with your umbrella?" What I'm speaking about is the place from which our actions derive, and how important it is not to lose the energy of our soul by hardening our hearts and walling ourselves off, as becomes so easily to do from others' threats. Donald Trump and Star Wars notwithstanding, there's no real divide between good and evil, God and the devil. There really is no enemy, which is why the Dalai Lama can speak of the Chinese as my friends, the enemy. Two boys were talking about their experience in UU religious education about the business of evil and the devil, and one said to the other, "I just don't get this business about there not being a devil." The other was trying to be very helpful. He said, "Oh, I think that's easy. You remember, you used to believe in Santa Claus, and then we found out there wasn't one? I think it's the same thing. It's probably just your dad." Now, dads are not devils, nor mothers, nor siblings, nor children, nor attack dogs, not even really, truly tyrannical political leaders. We are all of us, often in the most misguided of ways, just trying to meet our discounted needs, accept our frightening vulnerability, and find some happiness. When we are betrayed by a partner, attacked by a dog, mugged, or face some very upsetting inner feeling, or hear of a new terrorist attack, we have an opportunity, very precious, to open a little more to life, to become a bit more compassionate, to become a little more connected to a life that's larger than we. To connect with our own feelings when they're very upsetting, to connect with our own needs when they seem too much, and to understand that everyone else is trying to do the same thing with the only strategies they know, this can become a mission for us. Sometimes I believe we minimize the impact of our seventh Unitarian Universalist principle that affirms respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. When we truly absorb into our mind and heart and body that we are of a common family, then everything changes. What does it mean to be vulnerable? It means we can become connected. Or as the Zen teacher Dogen long ago put it, we can become intimate with all things. Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn served prison sentence for his stand against Russian autocracy. Nevertheless, he could write these words: "If only it were so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" May that which frightens us become a door that opens our hearts. I invite us into a period of reflection, of meditation. I invite us to open to something inside of us that maybe we have walled out from our full experience of living. And following this reflection, I invite you to then name this item and put it on a 3x5 card that you were given as you came in. And I probably have a pencil. If not, we'll make sure there are more pencils available. And then, if you wish, to come forward and offer your card into the basket in front of us, which in this particular rite represents the interconnected web from which we have separated an aspect of ourselves but want to reaffirm. For example, might we attend to the strengths that we play down because we fear we may stand out too much. To the weaknesses we cover over because we aren't so sure we can handle them, or if we did, that others would care for us. To regrettable acts that we have disguised by pretending they were necessary. To arguments we have erected between ourselves and those we love because we feared the intimacy of too much peace. To the cries of the inner child within us that we have criticized in order to resist giving it loving attention. To not letting others know what you really think for the fear of being known. To new ideas we've scorned for worry that they might change our life. To not saying we're sorry or that we are grateful. To the joy that we experience in life that naturally arises, but we suppress because there is so much pain around us. Please take a few moments to include whatever vulnerability comes to your own mind. Amen.